The Honorable, the Chief Justice and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oyez, 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 all persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
Justice Sotomayor has the opinion of the court this morning in case 22-1079, Truck Insurance Exchange versus Kaiser Gypsum Company.
Truck Insurance Exchange is the primary insurer for companies that manufactured and sold products containing asbestos. Those companies filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy after facing thousands of asbestos-related lawsuits. Truck is obligated to pay up to $500,000 per asbestos claim, covered under its insurance contracts with the companies. Truck sought to object to the company's bankruptcy reorganization plan, primarily because the plan lacked disclosure requirements that Truck thinks could save it from paying millions of dollars in fraudulent claims. Section 1109B of the Bankruptcy Code allows any, quote, party in interest, close quote, to raise and be heard on any issue in a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The question in this case is whether an insurer such as Truck, with financial responsibility for a bankruptcy claim, is a party in interest under this provision. The Court of Appeals concluded that Truck was not a party in interest because the reorganization plan was insurance neutral. That is, the plan neither increased Truck's pre-petition obligations nor impaired its rights under the insurance contracts. We disagree. The insurance neutrality doctrine conflates the merits of an insurer's objection with the threshold 1109B question of who qualifies as a party in interest. So Section 1109B asks whether the reorganization proceedings might directly affect a prospective party, not how a particular reorganization plan affects that party. We conclude that insurers such as Truck, with financial responsibility for bankruptcy claims, are sufficiently concerned with or affected by the proceedings to be a party in interest that can raise objections to a reorganization plan. Bankruptcy reorganization proceedings can affect an insurer's interest in myriad ways. Truck, for example, will have to pay the vast majority of the company's asbestos liability, and the potential financial harm from millions of dollars in fraudulent claims gives Truck an interest in the bankruptcy proceedings. Section 1109B grants insurers neither a vote nor a voice in reorganization, nor a veto in reorganization proceedings. It simply provides them a voice. For these and other reasons set forth in the opinion, the judgment of the Court of Appeals is reversed and the case is remanded for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. The decision of the Court is unanimous. Justice Alito took no part in the consideration or decision of this case.
Justice Thomas has the opinion of the Court in case 23-146, Connolly versus United States.
This case comes to us on a writ of certiorari to the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. Michael Connolly and his brother were the sole shareholders of a successful building supply company. The brothers entered into an agreement intended to keep the business in the family if either brother died. Under their agreement, the company would be required to redeem the deceased brother's shares at fair market value. To ensure that the company would have enough money to redeem the shares if required, the company obtained a $3.5 million life insurance policy on each brother, or policies on each brother. Michael passed away, and the company used $3 million of the insurance policy to redeem his shares. A dispute arose between the executor of Michael's estate and the IRS about how to determine the value of Michael's shares for the purposes of estate tax. The question in this case is whether the company's contractual obligation to redeem Michael's shares at fair market value offset the value of the life insurance proceeds committed to funding that purchase? The Court of Appeals concluded that the answer was no. In an opinion filed with the clerk today, we affirm. When a company redeems shares at fair market value, the transaction generally has no effect on the shareholder's economic interest. After a share redemption at fair market value, the former shareholder of the redeemed shares holds the same value in cash, and the remaining shareholders hold a proportionately larger share of a less valuable company. So no willing buyer of Michael's shares would have considered the company's contractual obligation to redeem Michael's shares as a liability that would reduce the value of those shares. The estate's contrary position would require us to value Michael's shares based on the value of the company after the redemption. But the estate tax looks to the value of assets at the time of the decedent's death, not later. The estate's position would also mean that a company can spend money to redeem shares without becoming less valuable as a result. That cannot be right. For these reasons and others set forth in our opinion, we affirm the judgment of the Eighth Circuit. The opinion is unanimous.
I have the opinion of the court this morning, case 23-250, Becerra versus the San Carlos Apache Tribe, and the companion case 23-253, Becerra versus the Northern Arapaho Tribe. An Indian tribe can decide whether it wants to receive health care from the Indian Health Service, IHS, a federal agency, or if it wants to handle health care itself. Now, if it wants to take responsibility for its own health care, IHS transfers to the tribe the appropriated funds it would otherwise use if it were providing the health care. Now, it turns out that that is not entirely fair, because when IHS provides health care, it doesn't have to pay for some things that the tribe has to pay for. For example, personnel operations, payroll, retirement plans, auditing, all that sort of thing. The federal government has a very large operation that takes care of all that for federal agencies. If a tribe runs its own health care operations, it has to pay for that itself. So under the law, the Indian Self-Determination Act, the tribe gets a bit extra to allow it to cover the cost of that sort of overhead. That amount is called contract support costs. So let's say the tribe got $90 million to run its own health care program, the money IHS would otherwise use if it were providing health care, the tribe might get another $9 million in contract support costs. Those numbers are just made up, so you get the idea. Now, both IHS, when it runs health care, and the tribes, when they do, have another source to help pay for the health care they provide. Sometimes the individual tribal members have insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, or private insurers. Now, whoever is providing the service, IHS or the tribe, can receive insurance payments if they provide services to an insured tribal member. The money then, of course, has to be plowed back into providing health care. So if IHS were running the program and got $20 million from insurance, it would have another $20 million to spend on health care. If the tribe ran the same program, it would also get $20 million from insurance, but it could not spend all of that on health care. Because remember, it would have to spend some of that money on overhead, say $2 million. So the tribe would have less to spend on health care because it wanted to run its own program. Now, two tribes, the San Carlos Apache from Arizona and the Northern Arapaho from Wyoming, sued the federal government, arguing that under the law, they were entitled to contract support costs on the $20 million in our hypothetical from insurance that they spent providing health care, as they were required to do so under the law. The federal government said no, it only had to pay support costs on money the tribes got from the federal government, not from insurance, even though the federal law said the tribes had to spend both amounts on health care. Now, who's right depends on an interpretation of a very complicated set of statutory provisions, including 42 U.S.C. Section 1395 QQA and 25 U.S.C. Section 5325 small a 3 big A II. Now, these provisions do not readily lend themselves to oral presentation. So to cut to the chase, the court determines that the tribes are correct in their interpretation of the law. They are entitled to contract support costs on the money they spend on health care that they receive from the government and the money they spend on health care that they receive from third-party sources like insurance. That means that the Court of Appeals decisions in these cases are affirmed. Justice Kavanaugh has filed a dissenting opinion, joined by Justices Thomas, Alito, and Barrett. Mr. Clerk, the court will entertain motions for admission to the bar.
A group of attorneys from the University of the Pacific McGeorge School of Law, presented by Dean Michael Schwartz.
Dean Schwartz.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys. From California, Esther Taihun Kwa, John Hammond Adams Jr., Leah Dawn Adams, Mark Stephen Adams, Bridget Christine Berrios, Amy Jo Catherine Brown, Matthew Cyril Chapin, Christopher Hart Doyle, Peggy Ray Wang, Sean William Joyce, Luinda Vosloo Lacey, Gretchen Meisel LaChance, Sarah Margaret Glennie Lang, Lauren Diane Lane, Todd Ronald Lowell, Nicole Marie Lowe, David Leroy Rowell, Lisa Veronica Ryan, Katie Elizabeth Belle Isle Sanders, Jason Wendell Schaff, Spencer Dwight Short, Nicole Diane Webster, Deborah Ann Whitcomb, Andre Lamont Batson, Thomas Alexander Urquhart, John Francis Olson, Matthew Dwayne Entz. I am satisfied each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted and the applicants will be admitted.
A group of attorneys from the American Bar Association Senior Lawyers Division, presented by Albert Harvey.
Mr. Harvey.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys. From the state of California, Rosetta Elaine Brumfeld, Leslie Lynn Macarelli, Anna Marie Sambold, Thomas Anthony Vogel, Roy Leonard Westfall III. From the state of Connecticut, Lisa Joy Capelli. From the District of Columbia, John Edward McCarthy Jr. From Florida, Jeanette Elizabeth Albo. From Georgia, Rickman Postal Brown, Kay Woodard Burwell. From the state of Illinois, Stanley Walter Fronczak, Delaney Adams Hunt, Keith Lee Hunt, Michael Andrew McGuire, Nicole Renee Sartori, William Gary Schur, Stephanie Annette Snow, James Baxter Sowerby. From Indiana, Richard Arnold Cook. From Louisiana, Troy Nathan Bell. From Massachusetts, William Chandler Rowland. From Maryland, Sharon Patricia O'Neill. Karen Joe Pope Onwukwe. From Michigan, Virginia Tomlin Wadsworth. From Minnesota, Lisa Ann Crum. Marlene S. Garvis. From Nevada, Christopher Mark Cannon. From the state of New York, Jeffrey Philip Elkinson. Lourdes Marie Fuentes. Barbara Mindy Goodstein, Curlin Jean-Louis, Wolfgang Knuckelman, Jonathan David Sands, Eileen Colefield Schwab, from Ohio, Thomas Henry Hisrick, from South Dakota, Tamara Patricia Nash, from Tennessee, Randy Coleman Camp, from the state of Texas, Sheila Denise Brown, John Garland Dickerson, Matthew Edward Furs, William Floyd Stutz, and from the state of Virginia, James A. McCauley. I am satisfied that each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted.
A group of attorneys from the Austin Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, presented by Stephen Brand.
Mr. Brand?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys: James Brandon Barnes, Krista Ann Shikona, Brian Clark Erskine, Michael Jarrett Fox, David Michael Gonzalez, William Nornhauser Hale, Rafael Hernandez, Jane Denise Kadirhan, Sean David Levinson, Karen Jacqueline Crawford, Ashley Nicole Morris, Elizabeth Resendez, Jeremiah Anthony Walters, Tara Lynn Witt. I am satisfied each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted.
Thank you.
A group of attorneys from the Phi Alpha Delta Law Fraternity, presented by Jonathan Blount.
Ms. Blount?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys: Alabama, Joshua Rodriguez; Arizona, Rebecca Lynn Sutton; California, Kristen Kimberly Boyert; Colin John Tanner; District of Columbia, Gabriella Marie Fallon; Brianne Marie Fisher; Donald Gene Quinn; Florida, Jamie Ernst Barrow; Cynthia Jean Miller; Jorge Enrique Torres; Georgia, Dana Michelle Leader; Iowa, Melissa Marie Lean; Idaho, Jeffrey Russell Jimenez; Illinois, Taryn Paul Singh Chavla; Patrick John Connor; Elliot Aaron Englander; Deborah A. Hawkins; Fiona Alicia McCormick; Yihao Zhang; Louisiana, Robert Davis Banks; Ariel Roshan Glover; Jackie Lyle Smith; Massachusetts, Matthew Thomas Breckus; Tyler Sidney Gilchrist; Maryland, Adam F. Grott Jr.; Michigan, Bobby Alonza Ficklin Jr.; Mississippi, Nathan Jared German; Nebraska, Christian Heyer Merch; New Jersey, Francis X. Unin; New York, Debria Anise Bradshaw; Raquel Veronica Chavez; Jeffrey Darren Hale; Alexander Galalis Hopkins; Oregon, Claudette Lane Mirasu McWilliams; Puerto Rico, Salvador Lugo Diaz; Tennessee, Donovan Eric Justice; Texas, Blake Ryan Burns; Nicholas Gregory Davis; Jeremiah John Isaac Hill; Virginia, William Christopher Dunn; Zachary Scott Lacey; Jackson Demarest Littlejohn; Fairbors Moazem; Asha Suresh Pandia; Keith Merrill Proctor, from Washington State, Yvonne Renee Carrick, Jeffrey Frank Dickerman, Wisconsin, Patrick Salvatore DeMoon III, Sheila Mildred Parrish Spence. I am satisfied each possess the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted and the applicants will be admitted. If all of the applicants will stand, the clerk will administer the oath. But before he does so, I would like to extend to each of you a warm welcome as a member of the bar of this court and an officer of the court.
Raise your right hand, please. Do you solemnly swear that as an attorney and as a counselor of this court, you will conduct yourself uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States, so help you God?
The honorable court is now adjourned until Thursday, the 13th of June at 10 o'clock.